everyone. Josh Nason's Punch Out has returned. Yours truly, Josh Nason, writer, editor, and podcaster for WrestlingObserver.com, former writer for Fight Magazine, Bloody Elbow, what other sites? Bleacher Report and some other websites that no longer exist. Hope you guys are having a great week. It's been a couple weeks since we last talked, but got a very special interview for you this week. Just got finished recording it. Sean Ross Sapp of Fightful.com, the managing editor there. He's been doing a lot of great things there and in the game for quite some time. And I've been wanting to have him on the show to talk about a bunch of stuff. And given we just had a big UFC event, ton of stuff going on, WWE and media stuff and everything. No better time to do it than now. So a couple of things we hit on this call as I go back to my list. UFC 241 just wrapped up, so we talk about some of the big talking points out of that. We did not go fight by fight or anything like that, so if you guys are sick of recaps, you're not going to get one here. Just kind of the meat. Dana White's boxing. This whole venture he's going into, he had an interesting interview with Chris Mannix of SI.com a week ago, which I urge you guys to check out, talking about the future of boxing with Dana White and Zuffa, or Endeavor rather. So there's some, Sean and I talked about that. Fightful, kind of, you know, how Sean got to be where he is and you know, kind of give the goal of the website and so on. And then we wrapped up with talking about a recent call with Triple H after TakeOver, where Mike Johnson, PW Insider, asked a question. Triple H didn't take to it. And we kind of talked about just kind of some of the fallout from that, the way people reacted to it, and kind of the role of media with WWE and his relationship with them, ours, and so on and so forth. Then we also talk a little bit about NXT on USA on Wednesday nights. So without further ado, let's get right to it. Good conversation, hour long. Sit back, enjoy it. Sean Ross Sapp of Fightful.com coming to you right about now. For the very first time on this here podcast, I think probably for the first time on this website for any type of podcast, we have a very special guest, the managing editor of Fightful.com, Sean Ross Sapp is on the other line. The notorious SRS is here. And Sean, we were just talking before, so I'll welcome you again, even though we just said our pleasantries before. I don't really have any you know, hard-hitting questions to start. I'll just ask how you doing and how are things going this busy week and busy month and busy year.
I'm doing good. I got back from Toronto last week. I was telling you off the air, headed to Chicago, got a lot of traveling going on, and I'm not much of a traveler. One of the perks of my job is that I get to work 15 feet away from my bed in a home office, so all this travel is new for me.
Huh. So what, do you have any specific travel tips you've picked up to not get sick and things like that?
To not get sick, no, because I seem like the only time I get sick is when I travel. Like Vegas, Oh, that was miserable.
Yeah.
Everybody got sick after Vegas, but I'm still learning. Like before the website, before Fightful launched, I had never really been, I think, west of Indianapolis, and now I'm going all over the place and kind of getting accustomed to it, so I got to – like whenever I interview talent, I got to hit them up for tips.
Yeah. So, well, I am a talent, so I'll give you some tips. And I'll give you these tips. Not that I travel a ton, but my wife is a bit of a germaphobe because she's a teacher.
Sure.
And very insistent on the washing hands repeatedly and all this stuff. She had these things called wet ones, which are like they, you know, kill 99.9% of germs. You get them for like, you know, a buck at Walmart or Target or whatever.
Or $12 at the airport.
Yes, or $12 at the airport. So yeah, very it's basically like a wipes version of like Purell. And I know when I've traveled, like conferences and, you know, shows and anything like that, I use those quite a bit, especially in airports. And ever since I did that, especially in conferences, I found I don't get sick afterward. That and a ton of water. I think those are two things that that have helped me out the most.
Yeah, I'm about to buy one of those water bottle with the filter in it gimmicks. Just take it everywhere.
Yes, very good. Very good. So about the travel, I wanted to a few things we want to talk about on the show, because I know people listening have different interest levels depending on you know, what they like, wrestling or the sport of kings, mixed martial arts. So a couple things we're going to talk about. A little bit about UFC 241, a little bit about this Dana White boxing thing. So I want to get your thoughts on that, because I know you guys do some boxing coverage there.
Sure.
a little bit of media stuff and also Fightful stuff. So actually, why don't I start with Fightful? Because I want to kind of set the stage as far as kind of who you are, what your background is. Because, you first came on my radar, I think it must have been a couple of years ago with the Fightful launch, or it might have been before that. But since, the last year or so, not necessarily short, it could have been longer than that because time just seems to fly on the internet. Your name has got out there more and more and more. And obviously, the Fightful brand and that group has grown more and more and more. And kind of just give a roadmap or a history of how you got where you are today.
Well, I trained in pro wrestling, MMA, catch wrestling for quite a while. And I always wanted to be a pro wrestler. But even 10 years ago, it seemed like 160, 170 pound, even 180 pound guy, too small for that. So I tried out MMA. I was in my mid to late 20s, and there were like 18, 19 year olds who were fresh and already more experienced than me. And I was like, all right, I love MMA. I love doing all that, but it ain't for me. Got a couple concussions and was like, you know what? I think I would rather do something else. And I've always wanted to be in journalism, media of some sort. And I figured I would give it a go. I pitched a column to Bill Apter, wrote for him for a while, ended up working for him for free for a long time. Mm-hmm. After that, I kind of bounced around. I did Fansided, What Culture, Wrestling Inc. for a couple of years is where a lot of people came to know me. But then Fightful launched. A guy out of Toronto wanted to launch a website based on MMA, pro wrestling, and boxing. I was looking to make a similar move like that where I could cover both more regularly. And of all people, Bill Apter gave me the recommendation, so that free work paid off. I got my dream job, and I love Fightful, man. I have the ability to do whatever I want there. Like, if I want to do a 3-hour NBA podcast on the network one night, I'm able to do that. If I want to cover any other type of thing, I have that luxury. It's been a really good fit.
Yeah. So you guys do. So for those, obviously, most everyone listening to this is familiar with the name and the website and all that. So there's a free version. And there's also, you have a Patreon as well. So is it kind of like a subscription model? Is your version kind of like similar to what we do, or how does that work?
We do have a subscription model. It's based on a Patreon format. We put a lot of stuff up there early. We have some exclusive podcasts. Like we have NXT 205 Live and a UK review. We have another review that's non-WWE stuff. We do retro reviews every month. So, yeah, we do a lot of that stuff. We post a lot of early access content up there. It's worked out much better for us than I thought we would, because, I mean, we haven't been in the game for decades like a lot of other people, and I myself haven't been. But it's worked out really well. But we also have free content as well. Almost everything does go up free as well, because I kind of want to give people that what we started with as well.
Yeah. So you're a managing editor, but obviously you do a lot of the, the content creation yourself. Do you have do you oversee like a staff of people, both free and paid at certain levels? Is that kind of how it works, or do you do pretty much everything?
Yeah, I do that, and I have a hand in almost everything. Every article that you see up there eventually crosses my desk, so to speak. There are some people that I kind of trust to do some like minor editing and things of that nature. But almost everything gets approved by me. They're like people like Jeremy Lambert, who have been with us full time for over a year. Mm-hmm. I kind of trust his judgment on a lot of things. And if I happen to be out, I'm comfortable knowing that the site won't explode while I'm traveling. I've finally gotten to that point.
Yeah, it's a good part to be at when you finally reach that. Yeah, that's it's always good to have a team around you. I can speak obviously from experience being in the Observer site for 10 plus years, and our guys Joe and Brian and other people that do the day-to-day and kind of behind the scenes, like they make the site run, and you have to have people that you trust and good teamwork. Slack is like the most amazing thing ever. I think in a lot of ways.
We run ours on Skype because our parent company runs a lot of things off of that. Yeah, I mean, Brian Rose was a part of our team at one point.
He was
phenomenal. Yeah, he was phenomenal. I got nothing but good things to say about him. He was really good.
Yep, awesome. So one of the other things, too, obviously, with really in the stuff that all of us cover has changed so much with everyone going to different streaming models, both for audio and video. It seems every single thing now, every industry is getting turned on its head with asking people to pay for this, but there's certain levels of content mm-hmm. and personalities and things like that. It's an interesting time, because I think everyone has to be better and up on their game, because people really gravitate towards personalities so much more than I think ever before, where it's just the institution kind of carried it. Now it's like, do I like this person? Do I like what they're bringing? Do I like kind of how they make me feel and the content they're giving me, especially in the podcasting space? Everything is, it's competitive, and it's good because it makes people, I think, be better and challenging and kind of challenge each other to be better as well. Cause they're like, yeah, I'm paying X for this and X for this. I want it to be worth the money, cause there's five other things I'd love to pay for and I can't do that, you know?
Yeah, that was my thing. When it got pitched to me by our site founder, I was not in favor of it. I was like, we built ourselves on free content. I would like to really hammer that home, but people were willing to do it. More so, like, it exploded relatively speaking for us around the beginning of this year. It's like we've increased our subscribers by like multiplied them by five over the past like 8 months. But I was maybe I didn't have confidence in myself and the content that I could put out there. But right after the launch, that's when really things took off for me, from getting exclusives and talent interviews and all that stuff. I mean, I had a lot of that before, but it really took off then, and it kind of made that worth it. But I mean, there are some people, I mean, occasionally I'll still have people that are like, oh, why don't you just put this up on the free site? I'm like, well, we do have podcasters to pay. We do have writers to pay. And I am not like adept at the world of website advertising. That's something I leave to my team, and I let them handle, and I handle more of the content stuff. So it is a battle. It's a battle to sometimes decide like what goes up there, what doesn't go up there, all that. And yeah. I want to make sure that the people that support us directly get paid, but also I want to, or not get paid, that they get their money's worth, but also, you know, the people that have been visiting our website every day since July 2016, I want to make sure that they get theirs too. Maybe they can't afford it. Maybe they're not in the right place financially. It is tough to kind of balance that at times.
Mm-hmm. I hear you. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about, we'll transition to UFC 241. Obviously it happened this past.
What a show.
What a show, right? It was actually one of those shows that for a pay-per-view, it actually paid off. The main card was all great. The decisions even were, you know, sometimes decisions go one way or another when it comes to the quality and kind of that excitement level, and all the decisions were good. Obviously the big knockout at the end. All kinds of stories coming out of that, but just overall, man, they're like, in a sport where it's easy to complain and just be frustrated, there wasn't a lot to be frustrated about after Saturday night.
That show was so fantastic. And I mean, hey, the prelims at times left a lot to be desired. I thought Sandhagen and a Sun Tzu would be a little bit better. Yeah. I think everybody thought that Casey Kinney and Manny Bermudez was going to be better, but the Kama Worthy TKO, that one was awesome. Imagine if that guy would have been in the UFC like 6-7 years ago in his mid-20s, like as charismatic as he is. But yep. Brunson being able to recover from that Heinisch head kick was really cool. Seeing him in his mid-30s be like, yeah, I'm finally going to get a coach. That at the urging of Dominic Cruz, like, and I imagine what he could have been had he done that in 2016 when he was on his hot streak. So who knows how that will end up. Sadiq Youssef was really good. But the top three fights on this show delivered to such a degree. Paulo Costa won. I thought that he won, and I didn't think there was that much controversy about it. But I'm glad to see some new blood towards the top of that middleweight division. I think Yoel Romero is effectively done at the championship levels. I'm interested to see what you think about that, because, I mean, he hasn't beaten anybody besides – I think he's got one win since maybe 2017. He ain't getting any younger. He's having trouble making the weight. Do you think that he's done at the top levels of middleweight?
That's a good question. Let's get back to that. I want to start with the Stipe stuff first.
Sure.
Let's kind of go. So actually, you know what? You know, let's go on that. Okay, because actually, yeah. So here's something else I wanted to talk about as I jump all over the place. Where is that tweet I just saw? Before it called the fight weights, have you seen this? What California released about the night?
Yeah, I did see that.
Yeah, so Costa was winning. So weighed in at 186, went in there at 213.8 on fight night. Romero weighed right at 185.5, and then went in there at 207.2. So they went in there at one guy went in there. Actually, they both went in technically a heavyweight. If you think about that, so. you know, I've been a champion, I guess, for I miss light heavyweight being the best division. And even though I love lightweight, I love what welterweight's become and whatever, featherweight, obviously. And it, like light heavyweight, that was my gateway drug back in the day, which I think it is for a lot of people, right? The, you know, the Liddell, some of you are probably tired of this, but yeah, the Liddell Ortiz. I mean, when they had Vanderlei come in, Rampage is at the top of his game. Obviously the rise of John Jones, just that whole era, even the lower end of the division was really, really fun to watch. And it was a much different time, but it's still for those of us that came through that. And that was so much better than the heavyweight division at that point in a lot of ways. But so when I heard initially that, you know, there was talk about Romero maybe going to 205 because he hadn't fought in so long, you know, Luke Rockhold had gone up there. I was like, okay, if some of these guys start going up, that could definitely deepen that division, at least give us some names and some interesting fights there. You know, I don't know if weighing in at middleweight, actually under the championship weight, if that gives Romero more, I guess, more incentive to stay at that weight. To me, there's so much wealth there at 185, so much wealth at 170, and there still needs to be more at 205. Selfishly, I'd love if those guys both went up, but you know, Costa, obviously, it seems he's going to be next in line, you know, for the winner of Adesanya Whitaker, unless something crazy happens with that finish. I would love to see Romero do a 205 fight just to see what it's like. Obviously, he can easily make the weight. I don't know what he walks around at, but I'm sure it's obviously heavier than 207. So, yeah, I'd be all for it, and he can always drop down if he needs to. But you know, as people know, when you get older, it becomes more and more difficult to lose the weight, even if you're an athletic freak. And I'd much rather see a healthier Romero for the next, you know, 3-4 years, if that's even realistic at 205, than have him has his career, you know, cut short because he keeps trying to make the weight and it's just messing up his body.
I'm a little more optimistic about 205 because I see guys like Ankalaev and Roundtree, the way he's been fighting lately. You got, I think, Clitson Abreu, Alexichek, Jim Crute, Rakic, Johnny Walker. There's for the first time in a long time, like a good batch of prospects. And then you still have Anthony Smith and Corey Anderson and these guys who are kind of still sort of young, but haven't had an established run. And as we've seen with Luke Rockhold, it doesn't always pay off making that jump.
Yeah.
I guess Weidman's supposed to make it. Eric Anders has had mixed results. But I think that eventually we're going to look back at weight cutting and be like, why did so many people do this? Why did this happen? I can tell you from personal experience, I performed better when I would just grapple at a higher, more natural weight, even though I thought I was getting some sort of like advantage. Now, I'm not an elite athlete. I'm not Yoel Romero. I don't have nutritionists and all that. But man, it's a little bit scary when you see some of these guys hit the scales and they're shaking, or like Aspen Ladd couldn't get approved for like by Andy Foster. Andy Foster was like, no, not after the last time. We're not going to let her fight at bantamweight. It's not happening. So I'm glad that somebody's keeping an eye on this. I'm glad that at least there's some accountability to some degree, even if it's like some discretionary level or hypothetical level at this point. But I was honestly surprised at some of the differences in weight for the heavyweights. Like, I think wasn't Cormier's fight night weight like 10 pounds off from what he weighed in?
Yeah,
that was interesting to me.
Yeah, he came in at 247. He was 236 and a half on weigh-in. Stipe, 233, weighed in at 230 and a half. So yeah, that was for some reason, and maybe I keep thinking that Cormier just didn't look in shape, and I know that his body is different. He you know, obviously was great there for 3.5 rounds, and you know, he's done this before, he hasn't looked great. I don't know if age is catching up to him. I don't know if the other things are catching up to him. And granted, you know, him being out of shape is 99% better in shape than most of the world, right? But I wonder, he just physically didn't look good to me. You know, he performed well, but just there was something there. I was just like, huh. And Stipe looked thin. And obviously, this was his lightest weight coming in. And, you know, he was a bigger guy anyway. But Cormier was touching up, and I was kind of wondering, like, in my head, like, maybe Stipe lost a little bit of muscle mass, and that's hurting his punching power. Clearly, that didn't matter because in the fourth, he came through big. I guess we'll kind of see how this plays out, you know, his next few fights. But yeah, looking, going kind of to round out with the weights, Nate Diaz went in there at 180, weighed at 170, and then Pettis went in there at, you know, 177 pounds. And weighed in at 169.5. So yeah, the big jump obviously was the Costa and Romero. But yeah, there was a little bit of weight difference, but not too big of a shift, I guess.
Yeah, that made the comments of Anthony Pettis saying that Diaz wasn't a real welterweight even more confusing, especially when you saw them in the cage next to each other, and it's like, okay, well, I mean, he's bigger than you. He weighed more than you on fight night, so.
Yeah,
and keep in mind, Pettis had tried to fight at featherweight prior, but I like this. I would like to see more information regarding this in the future because I think it's really – it is interesting, and it's also interesting to kind of see that the UFC heavyweight champion would have been a small WWE superstar about 20, 25 years ago.
Yeah, right.
By their weight standards. That's always mind-boggling to me.
God, I can imagine. I insert the Vince McMahon falling over in his chair gif when he sees guys like Costa and Romero.
Yeah, and the thing is, they're 205 live size.
I know.
On fight night, that's just insane to me.
Yeah, that is weird. Yeah, it's all about how they're positioned and you know, just yeah, those guys look. That's the thing too. I notice now, I think more than ever before, it doesn't. Maybe it's just the way they frame the shots, and I don't know how much thought they put in this. Probably some, but like small guys, unless they're like Demetrius Johnson or Kenny the other night or whatever. Like certain guys, they're small no matter what. But a lot of the divisions, they don't look like smaller guys. Like you almost feel like it drives you out of your head because you're so focused on what's going on in there. You don't think, oh, these guys are small. Then you look at like the tail of the tape and. You know, someone's like 5'5" and 142. Yes, it's like it's weird. Like I noticed that, like the heavyweights, it's almost like visually. And this is not going to sound right, but like I think people kind of get it. If you watch a heavyweight fight, how it's shown versus a featherweight fight, the way it's framed, you don't really notice. Oh wow, these guys are so much smaller. You just think, oh, you're just kind of focused in on what you're watching. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, I get that. UFC, I think, does a pretty good job with that. And man, I don't know how often they use the quote unquote smaller cage these days, but when you get a heavyweight fight in that cage, I love it.
I do too. That's one of the things about the sport that I wish they would, I don't say make themselves more fun, but like things like that, like when in other sports, like really in baseball, this is really only applicable because the field dimensions can change so much. But it becomes part of the story, right? Like they get, you go to Fenway, you have the Green Monster. I remember back in the day, Houston, they used to have this stupid field that's like this hill in center field that guys would get hurt on because
all the pole in the middle.
That's right, the flagpole in the middle, like that was a thing that happened just a couple of years ago. Finally, before they get rid of it, and the smaller cage. And I've been at shows. I'm sure you have with the smaller cage. I remember one in Foxwoods years ago. This was the night that UFC and Bellator were running head to head, both in Connecticut. And this was the night in Bellator that it was the Tito Ortiz and Justin McKinney, but the guy that came in with the mask with him,
Justin McCulley.
McCulley. Oh. That whole thing. So that was happening across state, so to speak. But they had the smaller cage in the Foxwoods shows, and it was the night that Mitrione fought Derek Lewis. Derek Lewis kind of was punching up, so to speak, called up Mitrione. Mitrione knocked him out in less than 30 seconds. Those smaller cage shows are a lot of fun because you have it makes tighter space, two fighters, your action just increases. But you never really hear them talk about it. You've heard fighters talk about that they didn't know they were going to have the smaller cage going into a show, which is kind of weird, right? That I just wish kind of a more thing like, oh, it's going to be a smaller cage show or something. It kind of have a little bit more fun with it, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, maximize that potential. You don't want to end up in a situation like where the heavyweights were fighting in, I think it was Denver that one time, and they were falling over sucking wind.
Yeah.
Maximize the viewership potential by making it a little bit more fun.
So let's talk about kind of a few of the talking points. And I don't want to like rehash the entire card because you did that on your website, which you can find at Fightful.com and so on. But kind of some of the key things that I was thinking about coming out of the show. It's well, I guess we'll start from the top with Stipe and DC. I don't know if I need to see Cormier fight again. I think I'm one of the few that was not that interested in DC Jones 3 for whatever reason, because I kind of dig what Jones is doing at 205 with defending against guys within division. I know that they're not big stars, but this is how you kind of, going back to light heavyweights, this is kind of how you build up a division, is you kind of give these guys a rub by giving these opportunities with you know, with these other stars to make them seem like they're worth defending the title for. I think it's been a big problem in UFC for the last couple of years. So I didn't really need to see it again. The one fight I would like to see DC in again is the trilogy fight. And I never thought that going into this Saturday night. But afterwards, it'd be like, if they want to run this back one more time, I would be totally for it, because you have convincing finishes on either side. That is, if, you know, if Cormier really wants to do it. And, you know, going into this, I didn't love the talk that, you know, there's nothing other than Jones left for DC if he beats Miocic, because I would have loved to see a Cormier Ngannou fight. I think that'd be a lot of fun to see. So we'll kind of see what happens there. But do you want to see a trilogy fight? Are you okay with Cormier just walking away and calling it good, and then Stipe, you know, rematch Ngannou or do something else? Or where are you at coming out of the main event?
I would like to see the trilogy between Cormier and Stipe, just because, I mean, it's who I consider the greatest UFC heavyweight of all time, in Stipe against who I think could have been the greatest heavyweight of all time had he stayed there in DC. It's a lot. There's a lot of what ifs there. If he retires, I'm okay with that, because I mean, the guy's 40 plus years old, but I think he can still do it. I think, quite frankly, I think he got a little bit lazy in that fight. And I mean, his home corner was saying, for the love of God, throw your hands up, put them up. But I did want to see the Ngannou fight too, because that's way more interesting than Ngannou and Miocic again, because we saw how that ended up, and it was not fun for anybody. I don't even think that was fun for Stipe. It was just such a letdown how that fight went. And I would love to see Daniel Cormier keep doing it. But he says that he only wants to do it if he can beat the top guys. He doesn't want to do it just to do it.
Yeah.
And I can respect that. If we ever see Jones versus Cormier again, I have no desire to see it at 205. I don't know what their hang up is on that. I get DC's because he wants to do it there. It's kind of the Conor thing where he demanded that his rematch with Nate be at 170, because that's where he got beat at. But I would, if anything, Cormier and Jones at heavyweight, with or without the title, whatever. But I really think that Cormier versus Stipe is the way to go.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah, if both guys want to run it back, and I'm sure that I don't want to wait a year for it, because I think there's a lot of, you know, that's a thing. Some of these long layoffs, it's tough, and the fact they don't have a, you know, intercontinental version of a title.
Yes.
I guess the interim is kind of the interim, it can be kind of lame depending on the situation, but you don't want to see Ngannou have to wait. You know, say you had to wait another year to see that. That's a whole year. We're waiting to see Ngannou fight again, and the chance of that, you know, the contenders rising is always a fun thing. And that rise he had before Stipe stopped him the first time was awesome. You know, it was fast, and it was just a new face in the scene that made an impact in a short amount of time. So if we can see it, and, you know, say Cormier say he wanted to do it, you know, if it was like Super Bowl weekend or something like that, I could see that. I don't think we'll probably get it, obviously, before the end of the year, but, you know, January, February, something like that, I think I'd be for that if they could do it. What I hope is that Cormier doesn't take it's his decision to make. I just hope it's not a case of months from now, we still don't know what he's going to do. Cause you know, at that point you kind of wonder, get a sense of, all right, who's Miocic going to fight next? I think that kind of builds and gets people excited for that. But yeah, it's, you know, Miocic, he wasn't getting really any buzz going into this. It was all Cormier, the E60 kind of mini documentary, which was really good. That was a big part of it. ESPN was fully behind him. Obviously, he, you know, he does stuff for them, that detail show. And he's you know, his profile has been raised so much with doing this media stuff in the past couple of years. And he's got so many things he can do outside. He doesn't need to do this again. He's got a ton of money. But yeah, if he wants to do it again, I hope he does against Miocic. But, you know, I also don't want to have to be, you know, waiting a year for this decision, because obviously that would kind of hold things up.
Fox likes him an awful lot, and if those rumors of them wanting a more sports-centric show themselves on Fridays is true, I find it hard to believe that they wouldn't at least encourage a tryout of some sort. But I mean, he's a fantastic analyst. Like, I remember when he called that Jones versus OSP fight, and his objectivity is what stood out to me. The fact that he just loathes John Jones, but he was able to stay objective in his coverage of that fight in the broadcast booth. You could kind of see that he was going to be something special in that regard. So this guy's got a lot of options. Good for him.
You know what's crazy? It's a couple of years ago. You remember when the Jones-Cormier stuff was at its peak, and people were booing Cormier. And you remember that the weigh-ins. I mean, he has fans, yeah. But people loved the villain John Jones. And you look for a couple of years later how much things change. It's incredible. His opportunities then, he was doing some commentary, I guess, but he wasn't as beloved as he is now. It's like that John Jones is almost that John Jones, that second suspension, everything that went on, helped Cormier more than anything that he could have done in the cage up against him, except for obviously beat Jones. It just raised it. It just like, it almost freed him from all that and kind of be his own man. And it was it just to where we're at. You mentioned, the potential WWE stuff, which I haven't really heard a ton about since those rumors happened, last year, earlier this year, whatever it was. But yeah, his opportunities are there. He could, I can't remember if I had brought this up or I heard someone else that he could be a Michael Strahan type that, Michael Strahan does Good Morning America. He did the Kelly Ripa show forever, for those of us that watch daytime TV.
Yeah.
But I mean, he's a huge crossover star, and Cormier has that ability. He has that immediate likability, the someone that, moms would almost feel good giving their kid over to her picture, there's that immediate, I trust him. And that's he doesn't need to get punched in the face anymore if he doesn't want it. He can make a ton of money and do pretty much whatever he wants. And it's kind of fun to see considering, where we've seen him come through the years.
Yeah, I like the Good Morning America comparison. He does have that kind of personality. I remember when he did get booed and stuff. I remember at that time he would be on UFC Tonight, and he was kind of a jerk to Dominic Cruz and Kenny Florian, would make jabs about them being small. And I think a lot of people kind of noticed that. He would do that type of stuff, and he would, I don't want to say try too hard, but it did seem that way. And then once he became a champion, I think that just melted away. Maybe he didn't feel the need to do that anymore because he was, he started to get almost universally praised. It was quite the turnaround.
So speaking of turnarounds, Nate Diaz back in our lives after 3 years, finally, and big win over Anthony Pettis. That was a lot of fun to watch. It was everything as advertised. Again, kind of fitting the theme of this whole show, or the whole main card, at least in a lot of ways. This was a lot of fun. We have a potential fight, we hope, knock on wood, potentially against Jorge Masvidal, which I think, given that the way that the division is kind of laid out now, title shots, and I think we're ready to go with Usman and Covington. I think that's good. I mean, obviously, if Covington hadn't won, I think Masvidal, Usman would be the logical next step there. But I just think the way everything's laying out, this seems to be like the perfect fight in a lot of ways. And we'll kind of start there because there's an angle of this I want to ask you about. But are you, I guess coming out of that, the Diaz Pettis fight, was that kind of what you expected? Do you expect a stronger outcome from Anthony Pettis? Or what, coming out of that, what were your thoughts?
I did. I thought he would chew away at the legs of Nate Diaz, and he did until he messed up his ankle. But doesn't really matter if you slip on a banana peel or whatever. If that happens, then that happens. And Nate Diaz did what Nate Diaz does and poured it on. Last place you want to be against anybody with the last name Diaz is up against the cage with nowhere to go. I mean, that's their sweet spot. Like back when Strikeforce used to line up kickboxers for Nate or Nick Diaz, that's where they would always end up. They'd always end up back against that cage getting a barrage thrown at them. I loved him calling out Masvidal. It doesn't really slow anything down in a division. Masvidal, all due respect to him, he beat Askren and Teal, and those are great wins, but he'd lost two fights just prior to that. But it's just crazy. Imagine if I told you in November 2015 when Masvidal was a lightweight and had lost to Henderson and Iaquinta, and Nate Diaz, quite frankly, was as relevant as whatever his brother was doing, because he was not the more famous Diaz brother at that point. Right. He hadn't fought in a year. He had lost to Dos Anjos. He had lost 3 out of 4. If I would have told you that a few years later that a non-title welterweight fight between Masvidal and Diaz might be the most attractive pay-per-view fight of UFC's year. And that's unbelievable. And it's a testament to how Nate Diaz, I think he made himself a draw with that promo after Michael Johnson. I don't think he deserved a fight with Conor McGregor, but he talked himself into it, delivered, and made himself a giant draw. Masvidal has made himself a giant draw. They have so many parallels that it works so well. I think that is the fight to make. I think it is a great one to make. You can go to Conor McGregor and Nate Diaz in 5 years if you want to. People will still pay to watch them fight 5 years from now. It doesn't matter. So I love the idea of Nate Diaz and Masvidal because that does clear the way for Covington and Usman. If you want to do that on the same card, that's fine. But let's be real. Diaz versus Masvidal would be the draw on whatever show they're on.
Yeah. So the conundrum here, I was thinking about this, is I of course, along with everyone else, Diaz Masvidal just works. I want to see it over five rounds. Here's the problem. They do not, and to me, obviously both guys at this point, you want to try to cash in on pay-per-view, I think. You could do, if you wanted to throw a bone to ESPN, you could do that. I don't, but they have this, they're stuck in this mentality, is we don't headline, remember back to McGregor, Cerrone, and the problems making this fight. They don't, for some reason, want to headline unless a title's on the line. And there's really you can't just create an interim title just for the hell of it for these two guys. So I'm interested to see what they do. They could do as a co-main, again, to a Covington, Usman fight as a potential, you know, one guy as a backup, but I'd much rather see this thing breathe over 25 minutes if it goes that long. And I'm interested to see how, if they're basically, if ESPN's like, look, we're giving you all this guaranteed money per month anyway, we want to pop a huge rating. Can we make this fight an ESPN fight, which would be huge, obviously, instead of doing, you know, a co-main event or something like that. I'm fascinated to see, for a business sense, A, if they can make it, which both guys, I mean, Masvidal should have just jumped in the cage right then and signed a contract, right? He was ready to go. And if Diaz wants to do it, that's always a big question mark. But I'm fascinated to see from a business aspect where they put it, because I got to think there's so many, and this is the thing with having, you know, TV partners and so many different mouths to feed, is that, you know, you take one, but you're taking away from the other. And yeah, this is that's why they get paid the big bucks, right?
Yeah, and I think it definitely is a main event worthy fight, but you do have to always have the concerns of when you book Nate Diaz for a fight, or any Diaz brother for that matter, if that fight will actually happen for any number of reasons, like just them being in a bad mood or whatever that may be. Dana White was saying this past week, they're all in when they accept a fight. That has almost never been true. They don't show up at events. They don't do press conferences. They'll smoke stuff at media day. Like, there are any number of things that could get that fight to not happen. But I think it is a legit main event, and it should be five rounds. And there's nothing keeping the UFC from making that five rounds besides their own arbitrary rules, which they break all the time anyway. So what's that matter? I think ultimately where that lands will be up to ESPN, because, I mean, they paid the rights deal. They've got the pay-per-view deal. So much of what UFC brings in financially is based on that ESPN deal. And, I mean, ESPN gets a cut no matter what, whether it's on TV or whether or not it's on pay-per-view. But if you do put it on ESPN, you want to talk about like almost a loss leader. Like, there you go. You do that, you might lose a little bit of money you could have made on pay-per-view, but the eyeballs that will be put on that sport and that brand in particular would be immense. I mean, Every bar on every corner would probably be playing that fight that night, and you'd have a lot of people finding out what the UFC is, who Nate Diaz is, who Masvidal is. There's a lot that can be done there.
That's huge. And you think about it, they can figure out a way with you know, unique things with advertising and things. I mean, they can definitely make. I know what you mean. Obviously, the pay per view to potential advertising pull is a lot different, but yeah, and that's the thing. They know what they want to deliver for their audience. And yeah, ESPN has so many different partners as well. They may be like, look, we want to put something big on, and we can do this and this and this. But this is kind of like their first big decision, but this is like a fascinating, kind of this early part of this relationship between the two sides. It's going to be interesting to see, again, assuming they can make the fight, how they play it. And I think it's going to tell us a lot about the relationship going forward. This is the business in the business. This is like the fun stuff of kind of trying to figure all this stuff out.
Yeah, I'm excited to see how it unfolds because that is their most attractive pay-per-view fight this year. It's their most attractive fight, period, based on the roster that they have readily available.
It was crazy when it's kind of wrapping up on this that when Colby walked in during the Heinisch and Brunson fight, and all of a sudden they're booing. And I can't remember if it was Heinisch or Brunson asked why are they booing, and the corner was just like don't worry about it. don't pay attention to that. And it was Covington walking in. I mean, he is for a guy that doesn't have any finishes, he has just been able to build this personality up into something that no matter what he does, he picks his spots. And I was listening to the post fight press conference with Dana White talking, and he said, you know, as much as he, you know, sometimes you just kind of roll your eyes at things he says. Some of the stories he does tell are kind of funny. He's talking about essentially equating it to being a kindergarten teacher because all these guys wanted to get at Covington, and all these fighters happened to be there, and they were trying to like move seats, try to get closer to Covington. And he had to go over there and talk to these guys, and it was pretty hilarious. But man, Covington, no matter what, he's again, for a guy that doesn't finish fights, a lot of people certainly care about him these days.
That's what's important, right? That's the main thing. Getting people to care is almost all that matters these days. Maybe more than wins and losses, is as wild as that sounds.
Yeah, and going back to the division stuff, guys going up divisions, the thing is that people care about names, right? We're talking about, you know, content. People care about names. And I don't think people care as much about divisions with some of these guys as they may think. So, I mean, it kind of just goes back to if you can create a personality that people give a shit about, they will watch you, they'll follow you, they'll do whatever. And that's, you know, especially in the era of social media, that's definitely what matters for sure.
Yeah, I agree. And UFC needs more of that.
Let's hit on a few other things. I want to ask you, did you happen to hear this, the Dana White podcast with Chris Mannix last week, the boxing one?
I didn't, but I mean, I got the rundown of it.
Okay. So I finished listening to this over the weekend, and it was, you find it on SI, Sports Illustrated's boxing podcast. Chris Mannix does that over there. And Dana White was on there essentially talking about this, this move into boxing that they're doing. It's been talked about forever. And not a lot of details yet. Apparently, he's hired someone to run it, which is going to surprise a lot of people, which is going to come out. The announcement's going to come out next month, September. And they're going to make some more announcements in October. I don't think anything like with a TV deal or anything like that. But it was kind of fascinating what he was talking about. And granted, some of it was promoter speak and what have you. But the two things that stuck out to me and where I think this could work, and when I say this, it's really just the idea of Dana White and Zuffa, or, you know, Endeavor, whatever you want to say, getting involved in this, is he brought the point about reinvesting in the sport. And he's like, you notice with boxing promoters, they don't reinvest in the sport at all. And USC, he brought up the Performance Center in Vegas, the one they have in Singapore, the one they're doing in Mexico. And it's something I didn't even think of, is that boxers that are going to be under this banner, or however they figure it out, they're talking about doing co-promotion, which is crazy considering how, you know, long he didn't want to do that in MMA. They're going to have full access to the Performance Center, just like their MMA fighters will. And I kind of thought of that, like, wow, that is potentially a big draw. He brought up the health insurance stuff, and, you know, and there, obviously the pay scale, there's a lot of things to be desired and discussed on that end. But, you know, when it comes to reinvesting in the sport, I kept thinking, like, you know, as far as a pitch man goes to get guys to come over, or again, whatever the structure is, you could do a lot worse than Dana White, given what they've built the UFC into and some of the little perks that they can give, you know, some of these fight camps and some of these fighters. And I found myself a little bit more intrigued about how this is going to play out, and a little bit more optimistic that I think there is an avenue for them to get involved. I just don't know how that's going to work.
Well, I mean, they got to have content for Fight Pass, because all their UFC content is off of there. I'm interested. Like, are they going to go after the top boxers? Or are they going to try to make a go of it there? Or, like, what are they going to try to attract people with a bunch of unranked guys? Like, I don't know what they're going to try to do in that regard. But I mean, hey, Rough and Rowdy for Barstool Sports is a major draw these days. So I'm sitting there like, hey, maybe just have some of your UFC fighters box. And see how that works out. See if there's any interest there. Obviously, in the grand scheme of boxing, would it matter at all? No. Would it draw? Maybe. But I don't even know what the hell they're going to do. But obviously, Dana White has had like the heart eye emojis for boxing for a long time.
Yeah, and he's going to have to talk about he does this 5-year plan thing. So it's like we go in short 5-year spurts and try to kind of figure things out. Then we adjust and all that. And you know, I boxing is so weird, and you know this, having covered this before. Boxing is just, and he said himself, it's just the sport's not dead. It's not dying, but it is a very, to his phrase, a very fucked up sport in a lot of ways. And just, I think this heavyweight situation is one thing on top of that. The situation in, they're bringing this, the Ruiz rematch to Saudi Arabia, of all places. We can't seem to get the Saudi money out of our heads. So I'm talking about all the WWE stuff. But it's a really strange sport. And perhaps, perhaps he's able to kind of rein things in. I think it's going to take a lot of time. But yeah, in kind of the content wars, they have the facility, they have the infrastructure, and I'm fascinated to see how it works. But he definitely has some. If he is able to pull a couple names and able to help them get paid, there's also the angle of if you start to have some of his UFC fighters get pissed because the boxers are getting paid more. How is this whole thing? So it's another kind of like fun storyline to follow. Is how does this work and how do both sides kind of play nice with each other, I guess.
Yeah, that's what you run into there. You got to, and also Dana White will have to have that conversation. Like, well, we value this more. This brings more money in, and it's a completely different monetization model because I don't get the feeling that ESPN is gonna buy their boxing content right off the bat. They are in the infant stages of promoting boxing, which has been around for decades. Meanwhile. Or not decades, 100+ years. Meanwhile, when they got into MMA, it had been around in the mainstream for like what, 10 years. So their business approach and whatever avenue that they take to get here, I'm really interested because it's such a categorically different way than what they approached UFC, even though they're both combat sports.
Let's round the bend with this. I've been dying to ask you about this because you were on these calls, as I am, the NXT calls, the pre-takeover calls that Triple H does. You guys post the audio, and we do as well. I wanted to ask, what's Fightful's relationship with WWE like?
It's improved of late. I was shocked that we got invited to a series of media junkets, and I like to maintain a professional relationship with everybody who deserves it, like other websites and companies and all that. And quite frankly, for a long time, they didn't give us a lot. The extent of access I had been provided is they'll hit us up with some comps here and there. And they finally invited us on the NXT calls. But I think maybe before I came to Fightful, I had guilted their PR into giving me a couple of interviews because I was the only media at the Arnold Sports Festival covering those 8-hour-a-day shows, and they gave me a couple there. But it seems improved. I've developed a lot of contacts in WWE on all ends of things, whether it be talent, employees, production, PR, stuff like that. It's a lot better than it used to be. I didn't exactly make a secret of it. They threatened to sue us last year, and rightfully so, based on one of the things that we posted. But it's improved a lot, I'll say that. But my thing is, nothing can compromise objectivity. That's the most important thing. Getting interviews with like Becky Lynch and Braun Strowman is really nice, but if I have to forfeit objectivity to do that, it's not worth it. That's we our subscriber count has not changed since we got that interview. It hasn't had any noticeable decline or increase based on those. So I think what led up to those is more valuable than what came from those.
Yeah. Yeah. With us, of course, they don't let their talent do interviews with us at all. Sure. Which I hope to change at some point. And it's a frustration because, and this kind of goes in this whole thing about the takeovers call. So The post takeover call for SummerSlam weekend. They do a post media call as well. And Mike Johnson of PW Insider, guy that's been around forever, guy that's broken stories time after time, well respected, does his thing, and is really good at it. He asked a question kind of related to the blood and guts comment with that Vince McMahon made on the stockholders call, related to the Gargano Cole match because one of the guys got busted open. It kind of was like, kind of alluding to like, you know, to paraphrase, like you talk about blood and guts, but then this happened and Triple H took some offense to it. And I don't think really like he was pissed off or anything like that. I think he was just kind of like, you're reaching here a little bit. And
yeah,
it was weird because I think certain people have carte blanche to ask questions like this. You watch a UFC press conference, you see the same people ask questions and you have to ask the questions. And what I like though about the fact that WWE and Triple H, especially whoever decides to do this, this is like WWE proper doesn't do this. They don't do calls pre or post event right, or anything like this. This is like, for a lot of us, it's our only chance to really connect and ask specific questions. And so, you know, I think Mike was fully okay to ask it. He could have asked it a different way, but I wasn't like, oh my God, I couldn't believe he asked this way. But then you see other media members and other other groups that happen to get a lot of WWE interviews just kind of like pile on, like, oh, Mike shouldn't ask that. And, you know, Triple H is in, you know, he's fully right to say all this stuff. And it's like, I got really frustrated with that because, you know, they don't really understand that it's not, and to your point about being objective, it's about being able to ask the questions and having the outlet and having the respect on both ends to say, you may not agree, but I want to ask this question and I'm going to do it fairly. And the person can be like, can answer however they want. And then you kind of just, you go from there. But every other sport, and wrestling's not a sport, but people kind of get like, there's a chance to have to ask questions that people are wondering about. And that's just the way that media is and will be no matter what the industry. So I was curious on your take about all that stuff. Cause you're on these calls and you hear some of the questions and you've asked a ton of questions as well. You hear some questions that are kind of just like, oh boy, you're not going to get any type of good answer. And then you hear other ones where you're like, okay, there's a little bit of meat to this bone here, you know? So I was kind of curious on your take on all that stuff.
So I'm very passionate about this, mainly because I am $70,000 in debt from broadcast journalism school. But here's the thing. If your website was called Entertainment Observer or Mike Johnson's website was called Entertainment Insider, bet you get interviews. Bet you anything you get interviews.
Right.
For WWE content or WWE talent. Bet the world it happens. There are websites that don't do a fraction of the buzz of either of those two websites, and they get interviews. We see it especially with international outlets. WWE is in love with that. Like if you're based in Spain and you do 200 hits, cool, you're going to get an interview. Terrible quality for the recording, just Bush League type of stuff, you get interviews. I kind of understand why maybe Triple H was a little bit snippy. Ahead of those calls, you are told – keep it to the Performance Center, keep it to NXT. And that did seem a little bit of a reach because he was asking something. Mike was asking something that Vince said in comparison to AEW. And the thing that happened at the end of that was a little bit of a scrape. But Mike doesn't get another chance to ask that question because he's not provided that opportunity to ask that question. Unless you got Heath Slater out there promoting a children's book, you're probably not going to get to talk to anybody like that.
Yeah,
like that's the issue. And I get what WWE is doing because aggregation is a necessary evil in wrestling media for the majority, because if you don't cover everything, people will go somewhere that does and make that their habitual viewing spot. That's why a lot of these places that just aggregate do so well, because people know that they can get everything there. They know that if they send Sasha Banks to WLEX in Lexington before she does a show at Rupp Arena and some interviewer goes, wow, look at your arms, Sasha. Those are so nice. That's going to get covered. Meanwhile, if they feed that interview to Dave Meltzer or Brian Alvarez, they're going to say, Sasha, why you been home for 4 months?
Right.
They don't want that. And admittedly, they also don't want people, and I don't want to name outlets, I don't want to give them publicity, that just quite frankly are out there to kick up crap. They don't want people saying, like interviewing Paige and asking her about some of the stuff that got leaked last year. So that's why they got to vet these people. They got to approve these things. And I don't think has there ever been anything, Josh, remotely even resembling what happened with Mike Johnson on one of those calls before? Because I can't remember it.
No, I can't. I've been doing those for, a couple of years or whenever they really started. And yeah, and for the most part, it's respectful, and they do, he does, it's corporate speak, but at least he'll address some of the questions. And it's good because it's interesting. And to me, like, that's part of the thing of being in this, and you have back and forth because you help clear up misinformation, you get insight. And that was, when Dana White stopped doing the scrums, that was a big, that really sucked because you got insight into these things that you didn't get to talk to him about anyway. And now he's doing more press conferences. He does these kind of these mini scrums or whatever, but you don't have that with WWE. And it's, I would love to see them kind of loosen up with that. And maybe with the AEW stuff, if AEW really gets really gets going really well, and they've been super accessible, and it's nice to have, because it's not like, let us carry your water for you. It's a case of, we want to have our talents accessible to ask questions, because I don't say we don't have anything to hide, but what's the benefit in closing our doors? We want, if people are excited about this, we want our sites and other sites want to be able to represent that, because we have an audience we're trying to deliver to. That's kind of like the whole thing. There's interest, give them what they want, let them talk to people, and ultimately, if they don't want to answer questions, that's okay. But at least the opportunity is there to talk about things, ask questions. And if they're not giving the full answer because they can't, because they're surprises, whatever, they've got to respect that. But at least the opportunity to ask and engage. And I think that's a valuable thing that doesn't happen a lot in pro wrestling at that level. And, those Triple H calls are the closest thing we get to it. I wish there were more, but it's I was just kind of fascinated about that, because
that's as adversarial as I've ever heard it in 3+ years of the calls. That's it. Like, you don't have people going on there saying, Triple H, what do you think about Saudi Arabia? Like, the people that are on those calls, by and large, do it for a living or are from reputable mainstream outlets. There's a nice mix there between full-time wrestling media and mainstream outlets. And I can tell they've been vetted. It ain't hard. WWE has a number of PR people that do it for a living and are very good at it. But I mean, I've never caused any issues on those calls, but you better believe that when I was at that junket, there were particular PR people that were watching me like a hawk to make sure that I didn't ask anything too ridiculous. And here's the thing. If there's somebody and a question that I need to ask, I'm going to ask them that question if I have access. And it's important. I owe that to my readers and my viewers. But I'm not going to kick up shit just to do it. Like, I'm not doing that. I'm not trying to just ruin somebody. I'm not trying to cause trouble just to do it. I'm more likely to get a lot of retweets and likes and engagement on a story based on something overwhelmingly positive than I am something overwhelmingly negative, unless I have a full backstory behind it and I may be able to talk to a number of people. And I also get that maybe WWE doesn't want to give full-time wrestling media access to that, because you never know who their next source might be, quite frankly.
Yeah.
And that could be a question too. But the thing is, like, they want to be entertainment and they want to be sport, and there's this fine line between all of it, and they are able to kind of use whatever is convenient for them as their rule for that. I hope that Wrestling Observer, PW Insider, Post Wrestling, Pro Wrestling Sheet, Fightful in particular, get more opportunities like that, because they should. And that type of stuff creates buzz too. And I hope WWE recognizes that.
Yeah. Tria says professionals will do the same. I think that's a big thing. Final question, because we kept you almost an hour here. Are you ready for 2 hours of NXT on Wednesday nights on USA?
Legit had to hire another guy because of it, because like I'm involved in the news cycle and stuff too. So we brought in another guy to help like kind of alleviate that on weekends. Cause not do I have to take in just 2 more hours. It's 4 more hours because we have another guy that covers NXT 205 Live in UK for us as like a live review. But if it's on national television, I feel inclined to do a live post show. I don't know how that's going to work. I was not covering wrestling in the Monday Night War era, mm-hmm. or at least the one that matters, maybe the TNA, WWE, that short-lived thing.
Yeah.
You know what? If the first thing that we see on AEW TV is Homicide trying to climb out of the top of a terror dome or whatever it is, that'll take me back. That was the first day I ever covered pro wrestling. But my God, man. Yeah, I'm ready for it. I'm really interested. How often do everybody have those talks? Who's coming up? Who's getting called up? I don't know if we have those conversations as much anymore because, one, we don't know. It might be Mandy Rose. It might be Dana Brooke. It might be Apollo Crews, Braun Strowman, people that had no real top runs in NXT. Or it might be somebody who's been there for a long time. And I don't know what it means for the landscape, and I'm really excited to find out. Change is scary, but it's also exciting.
Yeah, they have a ton of talent, obviously. They can do for 2 hours, and it's always a risk because you give people too much of a good thing. Sometimes they're kind of like, well, you know, I can get this anytime I want, right? And yeah. with 1 hour, you know, that show just kind of brings you week to week to week to week and then takeovers. So it's so now they're going to be doubling up on that. The fact I don't know if it's going to be live or not. I assume it will be. And
here and there, from what I understand.
Yeah. And then the fact that they've been going, you know, head to head, obviously, with AEW, which I thought Triple H made a great point about that. Like, you know, people saying we're counter programming. We've been on Wednesday nights for years. I thought that was a fantastic answer because it makes complete sense. And I'm glad that, you know, those are things that you get in those conversations. Yeah. But I think it is a fascinating time. The content wars are on. I think that the fact USA is getting involved in this again and becoming the wrestling network is quite something. And I mean, they're looking for numbers, and it's, man. I mean, I lived through the Monday Night Wars, and I was covering that at the time for my college newspaper. That was a long time ago, but people were fascinated by it. And you were like, okay, what am I going to watch? What am I going to record? What am I going to watch? What am I going to record? And I mean, you'd be up till 1 a.m. trying to catch, you know, both shows and everything. It's crazy. Just when you think that things settle down, one thing changes, and then all of a sudden it's like we get, you're hiring people, and that's ultimately good, right? More coverage, more people. And yeah, we'll see how this whole thing turns out, man. But it's a lot of fun right now.
So yeah, I'm hoping that either network, one or the other, does the old WCW Nitro replay. Remember how they used to do that right after Raw?
Yes, yes.
Well, I love that. That kept me up to like 1 a.m. on Monday nights, and I loved it. And I think it'd be a wise idea. I mean, what are they going to do that gets better numbers to follow that? I don't know if there's going to be another season of Crisley Knows Best for USA. So class not ass, guys.
Right. That's right. Before I let you go, I'll give you the chance to plug, obviously, social media, both for yourself and Fightful, and how people can check you out, check the website info out, and also the Patreon as well. The floor is yours.
Yeah, we at Fightful.com, we cover pro wrestling, MMA, boxing. If you all don't like one of those, we also have FightfulWrestling.com, FightfulMMA.com, Twitter accounts to separate them, YouTube accounts to separate them. Fightful Select is our premium service. We put a lot of great stuff up there, early access stuff, exclusive content. We have a really good team of people who are versatile and covering a lot of things. Carlos Toro is especially great. I think you all are going to see good stuff out of him. He interviews a lot of wrestlers in Spanish, translates it to English, and has found a lot of people reaching out to him for interviews. In regards to that, we have Jeremy Lambert, who's also very good. But you guys can follow me at Sean Ross Sapp on Twitter, and hope you guys like it.
Yeah, and this has been a great conversation. One I've earmarked aside for quite some time to ask you, and I was glad you're able to do it. And I mean, things are going so crazy. There's no shortage of stuff to talk about. Could have talked in a couple hours, I'm sure. But big thanks for stopping by, Sean Ross Sapp. Thanks again.
Thank you. Look forward to being on again.
All right. Big thanks to all you guys for listening. Big thanks to Sean Ross Sapp for stopping by, Notorious SRS. Obviously, you can follow him on Twitter. Check out the website and support wrestling media. Swing a couple bucks for the Fightful Patreon and support their website as you do ours. Greatly appreciate it. Let's see. We kind of hit up all the big topics as we're recording at the end We had a, and you're going to be listening to this on Tuesday, August 20th. So the news about NXT moving to USA and having a September 18th debut date. We already, obviously that's out there at this point. I did want to look at one thing. We just talked about UFC from last weekend, and there is, so there's no UFC coming up this weekend. Hallelujah. There's shows, and if you listen to MMA, or you've listened to MMA, if you watch MMA, UFC especially, you'll find there's probably a ton of shows that, that, you know, obviously separate out early prelims, regular prelims, and the main card. I have found, due to traveling and other stuff, there are so many bits and pieces of cards I have not seen yet. I've watched all of 241 except the early prelims. I've seen nothing of the Uruguay fight night card, which I want to see, even the terrible main event I've heard all about, and the Mike Perry Vicente Luque fight. Covington Lawler, I think I've seen everything. I don't see early prelims really at all. Middle prelims there. Holloway Edgar, I'm all caught up on. I think the San Antonio Dos Anjos Edwards cards, I don't think I've seen the prelims there or part of the main card. Duranemi Ladd, the same thing. And then Engano Dos Santos, going back to last week of June. And I'm sure there's ones before that as well. It is a lot to watch, especially when you have other things to do, watch other stuff and all that. So if you're running into that, I'm with you. I run into the same things. And I was just kind of thinking that, you know, thank God there's a one weekend without it, so we can then kind of catch up. Because after that, UFC heads back to China for August 31st. That's the Andrade Weili Zhang strawweight title fight, women's strawweight title fight in China. The weekend after that, we have Khabib Poirier. The weekend after that, Cerrone Gaethje. Yeah, let's see. There is the 31st, the 7th, the 14th, the 21st, the 28th, the 6th, the 12th, the 18th, and the 26th, November 2nd, November 9th, November 16th, December 7th. So we're basically, if my math is right, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 12 straight weeks of UFC coming up. And this is after a huge long run we just had. That is it's a lot of fights to watch, but yeah, that's why we do it, right? October 18th, I'm looking forward to hopefully heading to, assuming get press credentials, Madison Square Garden, the TD Garden, Boston, Massachusetts. Looking forward to that, and I'm also doing my best. I'm hopefully going to get to the AEW show in Boston that is coming up in October as well. That's a lot of busy stuff going October. I got to go to Montreal for my day job, and yeah, so there's a lot of stuff going on. October's going to be busy. My daughter's third birthday. Yeah, and my wife's birthday's next month. I should probably do something for that. My 5-year anniversary is coming up in October. God damn, feels good to be a gangster. Anyway, thanks to all you guys for listening again. You have a lot of choices in your podcast day. I appreciate the fact you spend any time with me or any time with any of our great podcast hosts, and as well as other people in the industry like Sean Rassap. So big thanks to him once again. Big thanks to you as always. This has been Josh Nason's Punch Out. I hope to talk to you next week. Until next time, insert catchphrase here.